Welcome back to the program. Amidst all the problems the world faces, amidst the bad news that seems to emanate from every corner of the world, the field of social entrepreneurship is providing a bright spot in bringing change to so many areas. Social entrepreneurship has grown tremendously in the last few years. International social entrepreneurs are forever transforming the way we think about affecting change while beginning to really solve many of the world's problems. We're going to talk about all of this today with a guest that has been with us before. It is my pleasure to have him back. He is David Bornstein. He's the author of the internationally acclaimed book, How to Change the World. He co-wrote the PBS documentary To Our Credit, and it is my pleasure to have him here today to talk about his new work, Social Entrepreneurship, What Everyone Needs to Know. David Bornstein, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you back. What exactly is social entrepreneurship?
Social entrepreneurship is it's a field that's growing whereby people build new institutions or change old institutions so that they can address social problems. And sometimes it's building a new kind of business that actually addresses a social problem through a business format, or sometimes it's taking an organization that has a nonprofit format, but really bringing in a kind of strategy that's getting at more at the root causes of the problems rather than really just sort of putting on a Band-Aid on problems through a traditional charity approach.
Now, we've heard a lot lately, and a lot has been talked about and written about kind of a business approach to dealing with these kind of changes. How is this approach, the social entrepreneurship approach, different than a more business-driven approach?
Well, what social entrepreneurship says is that the way to build great institutions is you have to have people who are sort of entrepreneurial authors who just, you know, put tremendous amounts of energy and time and passion into building those institutions. It could be anything. It could be a new religious institution. It could be a new organization to help street children. Or it could be a business that goes out and tries to change the coffee market so that farmers in Latin America or wherever are getting decent prices for their beans. The thing that the institution is doing could be almost anything. But what we're beginning to see is that there's a process by which great institutions get developed. And this process has its own characteristics. They tend to be started by a few people, and they grow up from the ground over time, learning by doing through the sort of iterative problem-solving process. This is how almost every great business began. And it's very, very different from the way that historically governments and international aid organizations have tried to solve problems. Very often they've begun from the top with a predefined plan, a set plan, which they have then tried to implement en masse on the ground. And that approach to solving problems has produced much less far fewer great stories of success. So examples like the Grameen Bank, which is the famous microcredit organization, it began with just a professor and a few of his students that were making loans to villagers. They spent years and years and years solving all the problems until they grew large. I mean, they didn't, you know, the Grameen Bank today, which is known for lending money primarily to women 97% of the time, only realized in its eighth year that they should make that strategic decision and focus exclusively or almost exclusively on women. There was so much learning that happened in those first 8 years. If we think of that in governmental terms, well, the president is out of office after 8 years, and the Grameen Bank has just figured out its most important strategic decision. So you see the time frame is very, very different between the entrepreneurial process and the political process, which is why today we're seeing so many solutions coming out of the field of social entrepreneurship. Because it lends itself to creating better institutions, and it also lends itself to a sort of trial and error process that gets better as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's so many people around the world who want to do this with their lives. It's a fast-growing field, which is why we wrote this book as a general introduction, not for people who are already interested in the field.
What about the sense of permanence of these institutions? We think of the large institutions, the NGOs, as you say, kind of top-down structures that are there regardless of what's happening on the ground. Arguably, these social entrepreneurship institutions could be institutions that come and go to solve specific problems at a specific time.
Yeah, definitely, and they should change over time as well. I mean, one of the problems with, organizations that become very calcified over time, whether they're governmental or nonprofits, is that they may have been, like the Salvation Army, for example, which is a wonderful organization, by the way, was invented before income tax existed, right? It was there to be the safety net for society. But then, of course, safety nets were put into society. So, of course, over time, the Salvation Army got into other things like drug treatment and so forth. They do very good outreach in that area. But many organizations don't change over time, and they get stuck in old ways. One of the things of the social entrepreneurial approach is it tends to focus on innovation and dynamism. So you get a lot of young people particularly, and now you have many, many people in what we can think of as their encore careers, people who would be the retirement years but want to do something, and engage in some sort of a social purpose, are actually in reinventing themselves as social entrepreneurs. And I use this term very widely. They may be inventing organizations, or they may be going into other organizations and changing them. I mean, there's so many examples. I mean, in my books, I have interviewed hundreds of people, and you have people creating new kinds of schools, new kinds of outreach organizations that reach out, that provide access to healthcare services to groups that aren't getting them. Organizations that are attacking the problem of green deserts in inner cities where low-income people don't have access to fruits and vegetables. Better models for daycare for low-income families. There's 100 environmental organizations that are trying to figure out how to create green jobs, better way of creating green jobs, or better vocational training for people who are underemployed between the ages of, say, 18 and 24, who could hook into much better jobs if they just had a good apprenticeship and a good training program. The kinds of stories that we're seeing today is that it's not necessary to have the kind of low performance that we've had in many social areas. We can do we are doing and we can do much better in things like early childhood education, math education, after school programs. I mean, if people really knew how high performing some of the best organizations are in the United States and Canada focusing on some of these problems, they'd be kind of amazed.
Is that, David, an inherent problem in this that not everybody does know, because these organizations are relatively small and because of the way they're financed, even if they have tremendous success, it's so much harder for them to scale up?
Yes, that's a big problem. There's two big problems. One is the way we finance social change is we ask people to fill up a bathtub with teaspoons. So, we would never businesses would never grow if we financed them the way we finance social organizations. Typically, a business entrepreneur, when he has proven his concept, his business is viable, he goes and spends a few months doing a round of fundraising where he might raise enough money for the next 3 or 4 years of growth in a 2-month period. But then most of the time he's running his business and he's able to really focus on what the most important jobs are. Whereas a typical nonprofit person executive might spend 80% of their time just fundraising. It's crazy. I mean, there's no way that you can build great institutions doing that. And the other thing that's really a problem is journalism. I mean, journalism is so good at telling us what broke yesterday, and it's not very good at telling us how tomorrow may be fixed. And there's just something about the way the culture of muckraking or the culture of the fear of advocacy that many journalists have, that they really shy away from talking about solutions, even in a conditional way, even saying this is a potential solution. I mean, it's such a small percentage of our news really looks forward at the future and how institutions are changing, how new fields are evolving, and what the potential opportunities are. And that information is so valuable, especially for people who are trying to chart a career. How can they possibly know what the possibilities are if they don't have a whole menu of examples presented to them? I think it's one of the reasons why many people are far more negative about, the state of America or even the state of the world than really they should be. I mean, there's a lot of bad evidence out there that there's many, many problems, but there's extraordinary evidence that people are being very creative about solving problems that have never been solved before. I mean, in the next 20 years, it's likely that everyone in the world will have access to clean drinking water because we now know the distribution channels. We probably will not have another generation after this generation where you have millions of children dying around the world just because their water is impure. A technology that was, you know, that is 80 or 90 years old, in the West, we will have solved this problem, and people are going to look back on how could so many children have been dying up into the 21st century of this? They'll look upon it as if it was like bloodletting. I mean, it was absurd. And yet people don't realize we're actually making tremendous headway in some areas.
With respect to the ability to tell these stories through journalism, through advocacy journalism, has the Internet, has blogging, has technology played an important role in expanding that story so far?
Yeah, it has. You have many, many more voices out there. And there's a lot on the Internet. There's a lot of coverage of people talking about solutions, people writing about solutions. What there's still a shortage of is reporting, actual first-hand reporting, where people go to a place and using the skills of a journalist, they ask people questions and they write that up in an independent way. There's a lot of boosterism about nonprofits. That's why journalists are very skeptical about social entrepreneurship or nonprofits. They think that, you know, everybody's trying to, everyone's being nice to each other. All the foundations talk so highly about their grantees and so forth. So it's not always believable. And that is really actually a problem. I mean, I just founded a new news site. It's called Dowser, Dowser.org, D-O-W-S-E-R.org. Dowser is someone who uses a divining rod to find water. And our idea is we're going to use journalistic skills to go out and uncover stories of change, but we're not going to write about them as if they're good news or as if they're stories of individual heroes, which is too commonplace. We're just going to treat them as ordinary hard news. Cover them, try to figure out if it's really working, and try to say something that provides an insight to people. And I think if more journalists become comfortable with that approach, we'll see people will change their behavior once they recognize how many opportunities there are to plug in to this emerging landscape of jobs and career paths that allows them to align their talents, their interests, their abilities, and have a real impact. I mean, I don't think that there's anything that makes people happier.
I want to talk about the relationship between these small grassroots, if there is one, between these small grassroots organizations that are having this success, in many cases unheralded, and the larger kind of top-down organizations, whether it's the Ford Foundation, the Gates Foundation, et cetera. And is there a way for these institutions to work together where the larger institutions are more supportive of what's going on the ground, what's coming up from the grassroots?
Yeah, there's a real way that can really happen. And incidentally, we are seeing a lot of the social entrepreneurs in the United States have experienced tremendous growth. You know, organizations like Year Up, Teach for America, the Harlem Children's Zone. I mean, they're growing, you know, gangbusters, and they're really getting a lot of attention. And they're getting a lot of attention right now from the Obama administration, from Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, who just spoke at KIPP, which is the largest network of high-performing charter schools in the United States, the KIPP schools. They have 82 schools, breaking all sorts of records in terms of moving low-income students, moving the academic needle for low-income students. But still, you know, for a lot of the bigger foundations, and I think actually the Gates Foundation and the Ford Foundations are actually pretty good about social entrepreneurship. They have really looked into how they can actually meet the funding needs of entrepreneurs. The basic difference between entrepreneurs and people who are not really thinking about growing organizations is that entrepreneurs need growth funding. They need the equivalent of what equity provides in a business context. Equity is basically the money that you get up front when you're starting a company that allows you to make all the mistakes you need to make over the next 3 or 4 years until you're making a profit. Amazon.com didn't turn a profit for 6 years. They needed a lot of money to build up a very big platform before they could show that there were returns. The same thing often happens with social organization. It takes them a few years to grow and spread and work out all the kinks in their systems until they can demonstrate that they're making tremendous impact. And then once the impact is proven, you know, very often it's a huge money saver for the government, it's a huge tax saver, but so many organizations never get to that point because they get money, here's a $50,000 grant, here's a $10,000 grant. It comes in these small installments, which just, you know, you have the entrepreneur running around every day, you know, like trying to, like I said, fill up the bathtub with spoonfuls, and they don't actually get the kind of support that they need to build a great institution. If we rationalize the financing for social organizations, we would have tremendous gains over the next 10 or 15 years in all sorts of problems we're trying to address now.
What about governments and the role that they play, not just the U.S. government, but governments around the world?
Governments need social entrepreneurs desperately. I mean, whether it's the politics, the staffing, or the policy ideas, in every country that I've been to where social entrepreneurs are free to work, where individual creative problem solvers are building organizations to solve problems, social entrepreneurs can bring into government a range of policy ideas and approaches that would vastly improve the government's ability to fulfill its mandate, which is to do what the public wants. In many cases, it's to solve these problems. You know, historically, the government and the social arena have not worked together that closely for a number of reasons. I mean, social entrepreneurs tend to feel it's very burdensome to comply with government regulations and application guidelines, and you need a whole infrastructure. Secondly, the way governments are used to funding things, they're used to, like I said, you know, governments want to pay for service providers that are the low-cost providers. I mean, that's a typical way that a government might fund, say, for example, foster care. Now, buying the low-cost foster care service for kids in foster care is not necessarily going to transform the lives of young people. We have a foster care system in this country where 50% of the kids who age out of the system, and probably more than that, end up having a really negative outcome. It's probably even higher than that. That's a conservative estimate, which means that they end up either have a problem with the criminal justice system, or they end up using drugs, or they end up not being independent. And we spend billions on this. Now, there are organizations, one of them is called Youth Villages, it's based in Tennessee, that actually has a radically different model for treating the foster care situation. They go into families, they try wherever possible to reunite kids with their families, and they bring in all of these services so families become stronger and more resilient and healthier. Now, this ends up being a lot less expensive, and it ends up having a much, much better outcome for the youth. But it's been a huge, huge headache to try to get governments to change the way that they work, because it means supporting the growth of an organization like Youth Villages, rather than paying for a bed in an institution, which is something that they're used to doing. So for governments, you know, there's all sorts of changes in the operation manuals and the way government payouts work and the way legislation is written, and also in the relationships that people in government have. You know, if governments could come to know the field of social entrepreneurship more intimately, if there were people moving back and forth more easily, we would have, you know, I mean, the solutions are there. They're just aching to be scaled up, and they desperately need governments to fund them, but not in the old-fashioned way, not for the government to come in and just buy a set of services. Governments have to invest in institutions.
Is there a danger from government, from large foundations, from large bureaucratic institutions, that there has grown up over time too much of an infrastructure that is invested in keeping some of these problems going, essentially?
Well, the foster care system is a good example, the one I just mentioned. I mean, you now have a vast, you know, set of businesses, you know, network of businesses in the United States who have lots of beds, and their job is to keep those beds filled all the time with young people. Whether or not these institutions where young people are living, and there are all different levels of institutions, some of them are better than others, of course, but these people tend to run these facilities, are very politically connected, and their job is to, you know, is to make as much money as they can. And the way that they make money is they're like a hotel. They have maximum occupancy. Whether or not those institutions are producing the results, the outcomes that society wants, those outcomes are healthy young people who are able to live and to succeed as independent adults. Whether or not those institutions are producing those results, and they, by the way, they are not. They are not anywhere near producing those results. They still have huge vested interest in keeping themselves going, and they provide a lot of campaign contributions to a lot of people, and that's why the system just keeps chugging along with its dismal outcomes. So, yes, the social entrepreneurs don't just have to come up with a new model to solve the problem and then get that funded. They actually have to deal with the politics of this. It's a very messy game. And, you know, how do you overcome that? Well, that's an age-old question. I mean, you've got to be savvy and tough, and you have to develop your own constituencies and your own supporters in the houses of legislatures and so forth, and play hardball with the big guys.
What about religious institutions, and what role have they played? How do they fit into this equation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, historically, a lot of the social entrepreneurs that I have interviewed have not had really strong, relationships with religious institutions, often because, you know, when you're being funded by many different groups, you know, it's very easy to become associated as just a Jewish organization or just a Christian organization, and that sort of cuts off the number of people who might be interested in funding you. But I think that that's a great question, and I can speak from my own perspective. I'm Jewish, and there's a very, very profound idea in Judaism, the notion of tikkun olam, or to mend, heal, or repair the world, which is really at the heart of you know, what Judaism is about. And I feel that the notion of, through religious institutions, teaching people how they can be active change makers in their society, and it can be children in their schools, as six-year-olds, when they get their presents at their birthday parties, all the way up to when they're in college, high school and college and all that, but to have this active sense of how you can express your religious values through concrete changes in the world, I think would be just a wonderful thing to integrate in a very practical way in many religious institutions. You know, when I speak to young people on college campuses today, they always tell me the same thing. They say, please don't inspire us. We're already inspired. We already want to change the world. We don't need to hear wonderful quotes and stuff like that. We really just want to know how to do it. We want examples and stories that show us how are we going to do things, what problems should we focus on, where do we find the sources of support that we need, how do we execute, how do we recover from failure, all of those things. So religious organizations give people a lot of inspiration and a lot of, you know, deep feelings for living a life of love, loving kindness and compassion and so forth. I think to add on a practical dimension to that would be very, very valuable.
I mean, this is also one of the debates taking place within the Christian communities at the moment about the whole social justice movement and what role that plays.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you look at, say, liberation theology in Latin America in the 70s, many of the people that I interviewed in Brazil were profoundly influenced by those teachings that grew out of Vatican II. And, you know, I met people, you know, whose lives were transformed by the teachings, and who went off into rural parts of Brazil and really built up institutions based on that. So I think, and I'm sure it's what I'm saying is already happening in many, many places, and perhaps it's just not as visible to me because I'm not out there on the ground talking to that many people who are involved in religious communities. But from my own vantage point, when I've spoken to a lot of social entrepreneurs, I have been surprised that many of them have a very strong personal faith, but it's not clear that their organizations are really connected in a sort of a fuller or more robust partnerships with religious organizations. And I think that there's a potential for more of that.
You mentioned talking to students. What role does or can universities play within all of this?
I think the whole mission of universities has to change. I mean, right now, people spend extraordinary amounts of money to send their kids to college, and they basically are expecting the kids to get a credential. I mean, the amount of learning that you get out of university for the amount of money you spend is not very impressive, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's kind of amazing to me how people spend, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars for an education where if you went and worked in an organization, in a country, and dealing with a social problem for 1 year, you might learn more in terms of practical skills, in terms of really understanding how the world works, than a four-year college education. But people need the credentials. So that's why everyone goes to college, because you can't get a job without it. And you can't get a great job without a good credential. So, but what universities could do is they could reframe their mission as not just to produce graduates or successful alumni who will send money back to us and support our mission and carry on the name, but to produce people who will be change makers in society, who will go out into the world and wherever they are, be powerful agents who can reframe the discussion, who can build teams and build new organizations and really move change. And for that to happen, what do people have to learn? Well, they have to be change makers all throughout university. They should ideally be starting before university. They should be in high school and in elementary school. How do you cause change? How do you learn how to cause change? Well, you learn by practicing. You practice when you're a kid changing your school or changing your community, and then at the high school and college level, you work trying to change, you know, the society at large. You know, the Genocide Intervention Network, which is probably one of the most powerful anti-genocide groups in the United States, was started by a bunch of kids at Swarthmore College who in 2004, after the 10-year anniversary of the Rwanda genocide, said, hey, we've got to do something about this to make sure this doesn't happen again. And they were, of course, addressing the issue in Darfur and now in other places. So a bunch of college kids got that together, and over the last 6 years, they have just developed their social change muscles extraordinarily. Now, I think that there's curriculum possibilities, there's possibilities to link with social entrepreneurs, using your cities as laboratories, so that every kid who goes through college comes out with a really clear, with a very strong experience of what it's like to be a change maker. They could do case studies on these things. They mm-hmm. could try to create their own change, work with other students. There should be funding pools. Universities should put aside some money to invest in some of the things that their students are doing, and then to chronicle whether they succeed, whether they fail, what happened and why, and make sure that everybody who goes through the college comes out with the sense that they're bigger and more competent and more capable of achieving change in the world than they felt when they walked in.
And finally, is this, in order for this to succeed, is it something that really has to be from the younger generation, that it has to be grassroots in that sense also? Because among older generations, there seems to be, at least in this country, a greater resistance to change than perhaps we have seen in many a decade.
Well, that may seem to be the case, but, you know, I worked with an organization called Civic Ventures, which created something called the Purpose Prize. I was working with them as a screener. And so the idea was to provide awards to people who are over the age of 60, who are social innovators, who are pursuing an encore career, and that encore career has something of purpose in it. So they don't have to be social entrepreneurs always building their own organization, but they have to be doing something that has some social impact, and it's sort of a new stage in their lives. And the first year that this prize was created, that Civic Ventures put it out there, they had no idea how many nominations they'd get in. They were hoping they'd get a few hundred. Well, they got thousands, thousands and thousands. And over the past couple of years, and these are significant awards. These are $100,000 and $50,000 prizes that go out every year. They've now done it for 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure the exact. And you could go to the website. It's called purposeprize.org to see what the winners are. It's amazing to see people. I mean, some of the winners, the oldest winner was 92. Lots of people in their 70s and 80s who are doing the most remarkable things in the years that they thought were going to be their retirement years. Many of them say that I've never had more fun in my life. I'm finally doing these things that I've wanted to do all my life. I didn't get to. I put the kids through college. I paid the mortgage, all that stuff, and now I'm finally getting back to something that I've always cared about. And so I feel that, especially in the United States today, we have a generation of people who are going to be so healthy into their 80s, and some of them, into their 90s, they'll be very healthy. And the notion of retiring and spending potentially 30 years of your life not really engaged. You know, you just can't play that much golf. I mean, there's, so what are they going to do? Well, this is extraordinary opportunity, and now you have, and one of the things about that Civic Ventures has found with the older social entrepreneurs, the people in their Encore careers, is that they already come with these great Rolodexes. They already come with this great experience base. So many things that a young person has to spend years trying to do, just building up a bit of a reputation, just getting to know people who will be their allies and supporting them, who could put some money into their organizations or provide them with the advice about how to build something. People, you know, in their 60s and 70s, they've been doing things all their lives, and they can call up people, and with a single phone call, they can get something rolling. And so what the Purpose Tribes has found is that you get change happens very, very quickly when people who are experienced, get involved in that way. And now that there's this kind of connection between the young social entrepreneurs and the older social entrepreneurs, because they really bring different skill sets and different awarenesses to the table. And I think I just think that we're going to see more and more and more of this. And I'm very excited that the Obama administration is taking this very, very seriously. I mean, they really have their eye on this. And there's a lot of mayors around the country who have said, hey, social entrepreneurship is a great way for, you know, our administration to fulfill its policy objectives. We don't have to do everything ourselves. We could find ways to support the change makers in the communities, build up, let those trees grow as strong as they can, and it'll make all our lives easier. And so I think that this is it's a very positive trend. It's not, once again, it's not saying that everyone has to be a social entrepreneur or hero worshiping. In every organization that anyone starts, there's hundreds of people who have to work together to solve the problems at hand. The role of the entrepreneur is really like the role of the chef. You got to help bring all those ingredients together. And that's a very important role, but it's not the only role. And it's certainly, I'm a writer, and I feel like this is a great role for me to be writing about this. Other people are teachers or human resource directors or computer programmers. I see many people today who have really found a way to plug in to this emerging landscape of problem solvers in a way that really thrills them. I really wish that I thank you for having me on your show, because I really wish that journalists would cover more of this. I think people would get a different view of the country than you get watching cable news, for sure.
David Bornstein, the book is Social Entrepreneurship, What Everyone Needs to Know. It is just out in paperback from Oxford University Press. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff. It was a total pleasure.
Thank you.